The best adult album tracks, incisive comment on cars, coverage of motorsport from around the world. It's a station built around cars and motorsport. It's high octave, full speed radio, Sky Channel 0157 and 0157.org. Glowcast Radio.
Good evening. It's just after 8 o'clock on a Wednesday night. Live from London this week, I have made the trek down to the metropolis, and I sit opposite Tim Gray in Globecast Towers. Good evening, Tim.
Good evening, John.
And on a packed programme tonight, Tim, we have...
Well, we have all our usual features. We'll be talking about what's happened on the ovals in the States and on the road courses in Canada with our North American correspondent, Declan Brennan.
Good evening, Declan.
Hello!
And we'll also be discussing the latest F1 news with our F1 correspondent, Nick Damon.
Evening, John.
Evening, Nick.
Are you not going to say good evening to me, Nick?
Tim, good evening.
Declan?
Good evening, Nick.
Oh, it's like an episode of The Waltons already. And we also have a Super Scoop interview, do we not? Which is so Super Scoop that, in fact... Are we going to move the news for it? Because we've got a limited opportunity to do this.
The news will come a little later on in this week's show. I don't like to have the news at the top of the show every week, as you know. So we're going to play a bit of this music.
Which is tennis.
Special guest this week is a man who started his working career as a professional tennis player.
Yes.
In his native Netherlands. And then... while he was injured, he was invited to go and see a Grand Prix as a guest of the Williams team.
Yep.
And then he went karting, and he never looked back. And that means we can say good evening to Champ Car driver Robert Dornbos.
Good evening. Good afternoon.
Well, presumably you're still over in the US at the moment.
Yes, I'm spending a lot of time here lately. So I'm now in Central Time. So it's, just afternoon.
Whereabouts in the States are you at the moment?
At the moment, I'm in. Yesterday, I flew from Las Vegas to Minneapolis, where I'm visiting a friend and doing my preparations with my trainer. It's quite a humid area, so it's quite good to train. And then from here, we go to Road America,
which of course is the race this weekend.
Yes.
This is your first season in Champ Car, but it's something that you seem to be. Taking to extremely quickly and leading the championship on a couple of occasions already this season. Obviously, previously you've done Formula 3000 and a bit of Formula 1 as well. How does this compare?
I have to say that the best comparison you can make with the series is Formula 3000, the international FIA F3000 series, which I did in 2004. It's like the highest series under F1, but... the cars are equal, the engines were all made from Zytec, so it's all all the same for everybody. And basically the best driver-engineering combination in that series won the race, and it's the same here in Champ Car, because everything is equal, one tire supplier, and the circuit's obviously new to me, but I learned it quite quickly. And on the other side, having spent 2 years in Formula 1 gave me also a huge benefit on the technical side. You know, I'm now able to set up cars and... it gave me a lot of confidence as well to be able to drive in F1 with a competitive teammate like David Coulthard and to be able to challenge him and to beat him. So, I felt really comfortable coming to the States and comfortable in doing a good job.
And, of course, by coming into Champ Car, you're reunited with Paul Stoddart. What's that relationship like?
Yeah, Paul is Paul's a special guy. He's a real character. In Formula 1, he did everything he could, and for me it was a dream come true to have made my debut in F1 with his team, albeit the slowest team or the slowest car on the grid. The only thing I could do was beat my teammate and maybe a Jordan back then. But he's a great guy. He's he's very passionate about the sport, and also for him the US is a new adventure. The only thing he has to get used to is that he can actually spray with the champagne now, and he's running at the front of the grid. So thanks to him, we're having good fun here.
I saw Paul when he came over to Europe for the tour of various media to promote the races coming up at Assen and Zolder later in the year, and he really did seem quite happy to be involved in Champ Car at this time.
Yeah, for sure. When we did the European promotion, it's a new thing for Champ Car to come over to Holland and Belgium and maybe in the future more countries, because at the end of the day it's a world championship and they want to expand. Paul Stollert, yeah, he gets the benefits out of it, obviously, with the good results we're getting. The sponsors he can attract, and he feels very comfortable in the series because he has a lot more to say and as one of the team owners than what he did in F1.
And obviously, being a Dutch driver, these two European races are very important for you, but you came to motorsport quite late in your career, so have you actually ever raced at either Assen or Zolder in the past?
I did race there. Well, you couldn't really call it racing. In Zolder, I got I went up for my race license, but I was driving my dad's road car to the limit to get a race license. So I know a little bit the track. I know they rebuilt it. Assen, I actually did race in my first year when I started racing about 6 years ago in the Formula Ford race, and we finished second there. But they changed the circuit as well. What I hear from the MotoGP guys that it's unfortunate that they change it because it's a bit less spectacular. But I'm sure it's going to be a great event, and a lot of fans will come out there. And I think the Dutch fans have been quite spoiled over the last couple of years with obviously having got two Dutch guys in F1, and but the success never really came because we were with small teams, and that they can actually cheer now for somebody who's running at the front and maybe hopefully make the national anthem sound again, that will be an awesome experience.
For the last, up until 2 years ago, for a decade before that, the Dutch fans were really all behind one driver, Jos Verstappen. But over the last couple of years, there's a whole host of Dutch drivers who've emerged into the international scene, aren't there?
Yeah, there are quite a few guys coming up, and obviously I find it quite surprising that when I made my debut in F1, that still so many fans were hoping that Jos would come back. And to be honest, with all the respect for Jos, he is the most successful Dutch driver with the points he got and the two podiums, I think. He's getting older as well, and he hasn't been racing competitively now for a couple of years, so I think the fans now start to see that that there's a new kid on the block, and hopefully they're gonna all support me. I have to say the Dutch fans internationally, they're known for being very very enthusiastic, and I mean, at the end of the day, Jos Verstappen had the biggest fan club ever of a race car driver, so slowly they're coming towards me, and that's quite fun.
Let's go through your season so far. First race of the season at Las Vegas, and a podium in that very first race. So that obviously got you off to a very good start in the championship.
Yeah, that was very important. I mean, I felt it already when basically after the last race I did in F1 in October with Red Bull, they told me that that unfortunately the only option they have for me is to stay on as their third driver or test driver. But with the new regulations, the testing is quite limited. So they sent me out sort of on a hunting spree for new teams in Champ Car. And because North America for Red Bull is quite an important market, and I found this team. And so we signed the deal, and in winter testing already I felt that other drivers were looking at me like, oh, this guy is coming from F1 and he's trying to show us how to drive these cars or something, so yeah, in winter testing we were not really that special, like fifth or sixth quickest in testing and just trying to learn the team, learn the car. And then come the first race, I really felt, you never get a second chance to leave a first impression. It's really everything or nothing. So I brought my trainer over from F1 as well, that I saw them looking at that, and I felt really strong that weekend, and we qualified third and finished second. So that was definitely a very positive start, and since then I could walk, with a more relaxed feeling through the paddock, and everybody respected me.
You got another podium finish at Houston as well, and that was sort of, you had Las Vegas, Long Beach and Houston, those three races all on consecutive weekends, and a lot of travelling in between. Was that difficult for you, having that tight schedule?
Well, to be honest, it's the first time I travel so much in the States. The only time before I was in the States was to Walt Disney with my family when I was like 10 years old. So it's quite an experience, or an adventure, you could call it as well, coming to these new cities. And it's such a big country. I mean, you go from one weekend to another, but you fly in between to the different cities. Yeah, and obviously you can imagine if you have a podium in Las Vegas, there are worse places in the world to celebrate a podium finish. And then on the other hand, you come to Houston where you drive on a big parking lot, which they call street circuit, which is a bit shocking. But we got another podium there, and that's what counts at the end of the day.
And then your third podium came at Portland, which very different to Houston. It's a proper racetrack, Portland, isn't it?
Yeah, it reminded me of my days in England, really, when I did some Formula Ford racing and F3, Junior F3 in England, and the circuits there are very challenging, and if you want to pass somebody, you have to almost pass them over the grass because they're so narrow. As Portland looked a lot like that, and it was the first time, we could actually feel the horsepower of this year's car, because you had long stretches, long straights, and some fast corners. Yeah, and the car seemed to be working quite well there. We were, I think, qualified second. I had the pole in the wet, but obviously that didn't count. But and in the race we finished again on the podium. So that was a good motivation boost for another long stint. You know, the championship is spread up in in three or four quite intense blocks, because we had, like, after Portland, we had another 3 weekends consecutive. It's quite intense on the body.
Now, your first race win came at Mont Tremblant in Canada, which again is another classic circuit up there in Canada. What did you think of that place?
Yeah, that was unbelievable. Already when I arrived there, I mean, we hang out a bit in Montreal before, and then it was only 1 hour drive to Mont Tremblant, and you come in this super nature area, sort of ski resort, and it looked stunning. And when I saw the circuit, it reminded me a lot of Spa-Francorchamps, which is, still one of my most favorite circuits. It's a bit of a home track for me as well. And basically, in all the formulas I raced there, except Formula One, I won the race. So I feel I feel very, confident on those type of circuits. And Mont-Tremblant was everything like it. Very fast, high-speed corners, a lot of uphill, downhill, and we were very unlucky in qualifying. I missed the pole by a tenth because we had a battery problem, so the car was misfiring and I lost some power. But I knew I had the quickest car in warm-up. I was the second quicker than anybody. And come the race, I was able to pass everybody and get my first win. So that was a very nice feeling after having spent 2 years in F1. I almost forgot how it is to feel feel a win.
You mentioned Spa, though. I remember back in 2004 when you won there in Formula 3000. I think that was the only race of the year that wasn't won by Tonio Liuzzi, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's true. I had a very very strong teammate in Tonio that year. It was the second year in the series, and it makes quite a big difference in a super competitive series like that. Also, with where you don't get any testing, and most of the circuits were new to me, except like Spa and Imola. But I pulled myself up to him, and really since the middle part of the season till the end, I could really challenge him for the wins. And I was definitely the stronger guy in Spa. I remember my team boss saying, "Guys, it's a very proud moment to have you both on the front row, but don't let it become an embarrassing moment." And this was Christian Horner, who later became my team boss in Red Bull Racing. And in turn one, I dived on the inside of Tonio trying to pass him. And he just turned in, and we sort of touched. And I could, at that stage, I could just see the face of my team boss in front of me. And I thought, if we crash here, I better walk home. And then two turns later, I did catch him, and I won the race. So, that also gave me my ticket to F1, really. Then Eddie Jordan afterwards came to congratulate me, and he gave me my first test in F1.
Going back to this season, another race win a couple of weeks ago in San Jose. what was that race like? Obviously, it's a very different circuit to Mont-Tremblant.
Yeah, very tight street circuit. I would say it's a bit like the Mickey Mouse version of Monaco. But then again, with big cars and powerful cars like we're driving, it's quite a lot of fun. Even though the circuit was like 48 second lap time. Yeah, it was. I just really enjoyed myself. And with Champ Car, the races being so long, 1 hour 45, it's even longer than a Formula One race. The strategy and the way you drive the car and the way you use your fuel and your tires is quite important. And we had another problem in qualifying when the gearbox didn't work. So when they finally sent me out, that it could only do one lap, and we ended up like really far in the back, 15th. So I thought basically my race is over. If you start on a street circuit that far behind, you can forget it. And my team did an excellent job in getting me on a alternate strategy when I was driving most of the race on my own, and I just was able to push. I did like 20 laps, like if it was qualifying, every lap was fastest lap, and that way I was able to pass everybody in the front. And after the second round of pit stops, I found myself in P3, and then I passed another two guys for the win. So yeah, then, I mean, the confidence just grows during a race like that, and when you get the win, it's, you know, you feel like it's really a team effort, and it's great for the championship as well, because, you know, it's open again, only 10 points behind Sebastian now, and with six more weekends to go.
So the next round this weekend, at Elkhart Lake. Is it a circuit you've been to before? Obviously, you won't have raced there before, but have you seen the circuit?
Yeah, it's the only one together with Mont-Tremblant, where we tested that before the season started. So another amazing track. I would say you can compare it to Mont-Tremblant. It's a very high speed, and I think we're there together with some sports cars driving. So. Yeah, it will be a great event. The corners are very challenging. I mean, I think Charlie Whiting of the FIA would not approve some turns where you turn in with 200 miles an hour and there's like 5 meters before a concrete wall. But it's, you know, it just gives a mega thrill to drive these 750 horsepower cars through the trees. And so I look forward to the weekend.
The Champ Car series over the last 3 or 4 years has been dominated really by one driver, Sebastian Bourdais. What is the overall level of competition like in the championship?
Well, I would say it surprised me by how competitive it is. I mean, if you could see on some races where like with one or two tens, it fills up the first three rows. Yes, and Sebastian has been quite dominant. I think with the Lola cars over the years, they just, you know, found an amazing setup on these cars, and he was able to get to extract more out of the car than his teammates, and really, get the results in. So all the respect for him on that way. I think with the new car, it's more of a level playing field. Obviously, the teams have worked very hard. As a team, they still have an advantage. I mean, they won 100 races in this type of series, so the team is definitely knowing what it's doing, and the budget is good. That makes a difference. Guys like Justin Wilson as well. I mean, he had sort of the same career as me. He spent 2 years in F1 with a small team and a medium team. And now came over to the States to try and make a career. And, he can be very competitive on his day. And obviously, you have the fast rookies now coming in. And even Paul Tracy, you would say a guy of his age, with all respect for people who are 36 years old. But you don't challenge him that much. But, I mean, he's like in F1. You know, Michael was on his age, but he was still the competitive guy out there. And it's the same with Tracy. He might be a bit spectacular, but he can, on his day, still be quite quick. So it's quite a mix of talents, and it's definitely not easy an easy championship. I know they had some tough years, maybe 1 or 2 years ago, when the five cars were just competitive. But now I would say, the whole field is quite competitive.
Do you think that the fact that there are so many drivers who are new to the championship coming in this season has obviously boosted it? But do you think Sebastian Bourdais was sort of almost becoming complacent after winning three titles, and that's why there are so many people really quite close to him. You and Will Power, both within 15 points of him at the moment.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you have to place yourself in his shoes, you know. If you win it three times in a row and you feel you're quite dominant and everybody's hyping you up, and it sort of maybe becomes difficult or easy to lose your motivation and say, ah, this is, you know, this is exactly something for me. It's quite, becomes quite easy, maybe. But then again, now when you have to push for it, yeah, you have to be ready and you have to just work harder with your team. And he still has the advantage to rely on his team, because they, you know, they have just an amazing amount of resources and budget to develop the cars. And I'm with my team, I'm very happy. I mean, it's not like being in Formula One where you need 500 good guys working on the car. You need not even 10% of that. I mean, my whole team, I know all the guys by name compared to the F1 teams I worked for. I just called everybody, hi mate, how are you? You know, because it's such a different world. But still, I would have to say it's a bit of a David Goliath type of situation with my team being quite new, making some rookie error, making some small mistakes like mechanical failures in the car, and his car seems to be very spot on every weekend. So yeah, if we really challenge for the title, we need to raise our game every minute of the day to the maximum.
What about the future? Have you got any plans to return to Formula One, or are you quite happy in Champ Car for the moment?
No, to be honest, I would love to turn one. I mean, it does feel almost a little bit like unfinished business in F1, because I never was in a position to challenge for points, or I came very close in with Red Bull when I qualified in the top 10 and was running ninth, and you know, but you never really had the chance to get to taste the success, you know, except for beating a teammate. So if there's a competitive team I can come back with, yes, I would love to. And but I can now say honestly, you know, I'm in quite in a luxury position, because you know, I realized already a dream come true, basically, to race in F1. And I never done a full season. We did 11 Grand Prix in total, but it's the push is not so hard, like everything or nothing for F1. I would prefer then to stay in the US and make a career here, and enjoy what I love doing best, is just to be competitive and win races. But yeah, if Formula One would come back with a competitive team, I would definitely consider it.
Okay, Robert, good luck for the race this weekend, and thanks very much for talking to us this afternoon.
You're welcome, thank you.
Hi, I'm Marino Franchitti, and you're listening to Midweek Motorsport with my friend and yours, John Hindoff.
So of course, I'm on a different hotkey bank, so that button doesn't do what I wanted it to do.
I quite like that. I haven't played that for ages.
And that's either what I wanted to do either, but it's on that. Okay, people.
Globecast Radio. All the week's motorsport news. Midweek Motorsport on Globecast Radio.
All right then, a little bit later than usual, the latest motorsport headlines. Tim Gray, what do you have for us?
Formula One Supremo Bernie Eccleston is selling...
What other Bernie Eccleston? What Bernie Eccleston who lives, you know, round the corner in Clapham?
There may be several Bernie Ecclestons. We need to make sure that we are talking only about Bernard Charles Eccleston Esquire.
Okay.
The man who's selling 50 cars from his own personal collection.
I noticed that.
How the world goes around his service and how he started, wasn't it, selling second-hand cars?
I just noticed, actually, that... a couple of magazines that I've had, Classic and Sports Car and Octane recently, have had advertisements, and he has got some absolute spankers in there. There's an SS Mercedes, which is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, but guys, the stuff he's selling isn't his best stuff. If you, when we used to obviously work with Bernie, we used to fly out Biggin Hill for the digital TV,
and they've got
a large hangar, unsurprisingly, where there are cars up on racks, and they are all the Brabhams, classic Lotuses, classic Ferraris, all Formula One sports cars. Oh man, you know, he has got at least 60 classic racing cars that unfortunately never see the light of day. I think he bought one out, didn't he, at Goodwood a couple of years ago. He's got two guys who are employed full time just to look after him, even though they don't go anywhere.
That's a crime, isn't it?
And it's why I think I've got no problem with people having large collections of cars. I have a problem with them not letting people see them.
Having said that, I can't manage to get my Triumph, Suzuki and Sunbeam rolling for any amount of the year. What is he selling, Tim? I'm itching to read us a list there.
1937 Mercedes-Benz 540K Special Roadster.
That's worth
£3.25 million.
That's the one that I've seen advertised. It's beautiful.
1955 Mercedes 300 SL Gullwing. Ford Anglia.
Ooh, what sort of Ford Anglia?
Just as a Ford Anglia.
Never been used in any kind of bank robbery or illicit activity at all?
Possibly never been used.
Okay.
It's expected to raise around £15 million.
Really?
How many is he selling?
50.
And three and a bit, probably more for that. I think they'll get five. Probably 4 million, I think they'll get.
I think it's for short cash if you feel sorry, don't you, really?
They're only going to get a few hundred for the Anglia, I'd have thought.
That depends what the provenance is.
He has a personal fortune of £3 billion, Nick. Why does he need to sell his cars to raise money?
I have absolutely... Obviously, it's not to raise money.
He's running out of space.
Why he's selling it. Perhaps he wants space. Perhaps he wants to... Well, somebody is saying, and this is interesting, if he actually is selling £50 million of personal possessions... Now, as you probably know, the actual money that Bernie has is unbelievably locked up in all sorts of very, very convoluted trusts. And if you actually ever look at a couple of websites, GrandPrix.com or PitPass, they love trying to unravel Formula One finances. And suffice to say, most of it is actually owned by a trust, which is owned by his wife. Now, those cars are probably owned by Bernard Charles Eccleston. If he raises £50 million, what's the rumour currently doing the round of what he wants to do with it?
He wants to buy into Arsenal Football Club.
So this way he's actually raising money for himself, which he can buy with his own checkbook and not go through any of his trust funds, and therefore have none of the tax implications that would have. It's as simple as selling things he owns in his name to buy his football club. That is the only possible reason he wants to do it.
Spyker's chief technical officer Mike Gascoigne says the team had reason to be proud after beating Honda in Hungary.
Absolutely.
Adrian Sutil finished in 17th position in front of Rubens Barrichello, the last classified driver.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting way of getting pride, isn't it, really?
Oh, yes. But you've got to love Spyker.
It's a bit like not coming last in the Special Olympics, isn't it, really?
No, Nick.
Depends if you're racing against the Spanish, I suppose.
You know.
Ooh.
Bit of Spyker music for you.
That was a bit late, that.
We all know. Yes, I mean...
I like Spyker. Yeah, I like
well
Spyker.
Done.
You know why? Because... There's no BS. There's no bovine...
Spongiform.
Whatever.
They know that they're making up the grids. They know that they're not as quick as other people, but they don't try and pretend that they are.
Yeah, they have got one big down point to them.
What?
Which is Calvin Kohler, who I personally think is an odious person.
Okay.
But, you know, yes, they're better.
They're having an open day at Silverstone.
But, you know...
Chelsea had an open day at Stamford.
Perhaps he wants to invite me to an all-expenses-paid VIP trip to a Grand Prix, and I can take my opinion of him.
Oh, no, I'd rather sit at home and watch it on the telly.
Now, yes. Back on Yamamoto, says he was angry with himself after spinning out of the Grand Prix after just 7 laps.
He wasn't angry with himself being 2 seconds off pace the whole time, then.
He was a replacement for Christian Albers, but he lost control of his car at the end of the straight while lapping at the bottom of the field.
Well, he's got some very, very nice money.
How did he end his season last year?
I don't know, with a bottle of sake?
No, it was sitting in a gravel trap, wasn't it, at Imola?
He did a lot of that last year.
That wasn't him.
Yes, it was.
No, it wasn't.
Who was that then?
That was the other bloke. The bloke who started the season for Aguri, who got kicked out of 4 races. Yakamoto came and did the last 8 races.
No.
No, the guy who...
Oh, stop arguing. It doesn't matter. He's a tugger at the back of the field with lots of cash.
I've lost the guy who lost his license, his super license. I can't think of who it was. It wasn't Yakamoto, it was the other bloke.
Declan will be shouting it now. No,
Declan's all very quiet.
Next story.
There's another Formula One story apparently going on.
Really?
Something to do with Lewis Hamilton and McLaren team.
Let me ask you a question. Did any of you watch qualifying live?
No.
Well, I did.
I listened to it live, frankly, with Radio 5 live, is not like watching it live.
No, and When I actually saw it happen, what happened at the, in the last minute where Fernando Alonso effectively parked his car a little bit too long and therefore prevented Lewis from doing one last lap, I actually went away with it and thought, you cheeky bee, but well done. I thought, that's what I like to see, a driver sticking outside the box, and well done for that, you know. And then, of course, the old stewards come in.
Stewards should never have got involved.
Well, when the astounding thing is... But
not on It's a Knockout, not when the Joker's being played, when you're in the final phase of the Phil Rouge.
Through the stewards first. I mean, the stewards first, they penalised Fernando Alonso 5 places, which is probably fair, which is fair comment if you think he did something wrong, which personally I don't think he did. I think he was clever.
What was his next quickest lap?
Good enough a second.
Well, then that's what they should have took his last lap from him.
Well, that's it. But then they effectively gave McLaren a 15-point penalty in the Constructors' Championship.
Well,
so, what they're basically saying
There is a reason for that. There is a reason for that. And the reason for that is that McLaren went in and said, we messed up and Fernando Alonso didn't. We held him to put him back so that he wasn't in traffic and it wasn't his decision, it was ours. And I think the reason the stewards have penalised McLaren is because they didn't believe them, and therefore they're saying to McLaren, you're lying and you're going to get penalised for it.
I mean, I think the problem we have, I mean, I don't know if you heard, but I think one of the things that annoyed me, one of the things we're very good about it, and it's interesting, if you read the specialist press, they go, oh, this is awful for Formula One,
it's fantastic for Formula One.
Brilliant. I was driving to a meeting on Monday, and Radio 5 had a phone in, and the two subjects were foot and mouth and Lewis Hamilton in Formula One.
That they had a psychologist on talking about workplace... Workplace tension and why sometimes it can be good and not bad. This is my 2 pence worth. I'm fairly certain that Alonso did what everybody thinks he did.
Well done to him, by the way. That was clever.
He broke no rule. There's nothing that said he has to drive straight out of his pit.
Nope.
He didn't do it on the track where it would have been dangerous.
He's broken
no rule. Bad for McLaren because they could have quite easily moved him forward and just said, sit there if you want to sit there, and we'll put Lewis's...
No, they didn't have time to do that.
No, that's okay, fine. But, okay, stewards shouldn't have never have gotten involved and certainly shouldn't be penalising McLaren that construct this point. The only thing I say about McLaren is they shouldn't have gone in and lied about it.
Well,
what happened was, McLaren sat there.
There's 2 points I want to raise on the penalty. First of all, effectively, they've been penalised for a driver waiting a bit long in the pit. They've got a 15-point penalty. For being in possession of a 700-page Ferrari document, they've got absolutely 3 TFA.
Well, yeah. Do you not think this part of that is
linked? There's a little bit of linking together. I think that
Which team do you think went to the stewards and said, you've got to do something about this?
Oh, God, absolutely.
Was it Spyker?
No, it wasn't Spyker.
I think all of them probably.
They tested everyone else.
Because Flavio is getting his nose involved. Because Flavio, of course, wants to stir it up. He's thinking it was an opportunity for getting Alonso out. I must admit, I was with Alonso, despite being English, I was with Alonso the whole way until the comment he made at the end of the race.
Which was?
When he was asked, will he be with the team next year? He said, we'll see. Now, what he's trying to do is he's trying to put pressure on McLaren. Say, look, I'm going to leave. Now, if your teammate was Giancarlo Fisichella and you're Alonso and you threaten to leave, well, your team's going to panic. If your teammate is Lewis Hamilton, why should they care?
Can we just rewind to
he has no strong hand, and what he's basically doing is he's actually bringing further division into the team. Why should they back a driver who wants to leave?
Well, can we just rewind about 2 months, maybe a little bit longer?
Should we rewind 12 months and talk about the similarities with Juan Pablo Montoya?
Well, I've been saying all along that as soon as they realised what they had, McLaren realised what they had with Lewis Hamilton, they've been trying to engineer Alonso out.
They don't want Alonso out.
I think they do.
No,
McLaren knew what they had with Lewis.
No, they knew they'd be getting quicker.
Middle of last year,
They didn't know how to be in Formula One, mate.
Tim, you wouldn't know he could do it at the level you've done it at.
Here's a little prediction for you. The two drivers that are driving for McLaren now will not be driving for McLaren even at the end of this season.
No, they'll see the year 3.
Okay, I think you're wrong.
I'm prepared to say that now. And Declan?
Go on, Declan.
I think the supposed clash on the radio between Lewis and Ron Dennis says volumes about Lewis Hamilton and where he is in his head right now. It said, this is, and it actually links to this issue about whether or not Alonso's going to be there next year. I don't think, if I was Ron Dennis, after I got admonished by my rookie driver, who actually had the gall to swear at me on the phone, despite how I had to react in public or on the radio back to him, deep down I'm thinking, you know what? He A, now, not only is he a star, but B, he now knows he's a star, yeah. And B, he knows he's a winner.
Yeah.
And I don't think they actually need Alonso now, because I think they already have.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that coming into next year, they don't need Alonso.
Yes,
however,
they
don't want Alonso somewhere else either.
No, and they don't if they don't have Alonso, they need someone to set the car up and do the development, because that's something that Hamilton can't do.
That is an internet rumour whizzing round from Spain. There is no evidence that Hamilton can't set a car. He made one comment about choosing the wrong rear end settings in Silverstone, and suddenly Alonso setting his car up for him.
He doesn't have the experience.
Hamilton
to develop
was faster than Alonso the entire weekend. He was quicker.
Listen, don't get me wrong, I haven't got a downer on Hamilton. I just think that his weakness at the moment, because of his lack of experience in anything other than a single make formula, is, and I know I called Formula 1.
He won Formula 3, which isn't a single make formula. He won
and
the title, he dominated the championship.
Whoa. That was a single make formula. Euro Formula 3 was effectively a single make formula.
It wasn't. They're three different engines and two chassis.
Yeah, only one combination of which was any good.
Don't forget that McLaren has a very experienced test driver in Pedro de la Rosa, who knows what he's doing.
And that's the key. And so long as Hamilton keeps in with de la Rosa, then that's the key.
Well, I mean, and you know, the thing about Alonso is I don't think that McLaren particularly need him for 2007, but the last thing they want is him racing with somebody else.
Renault want him back. Renault would have him back tomorrow.
Yeah, the strong rumour is that BMW are going to dangle money at him.
No.
If I was Ron Dennis, I wouldn't have a problem with sending them to or letting him go to BMW.
He won't go for it. They've got the driver.
Yes,
they
but
need.
Mercedes would have a problem with it.
Also, Mario Tyson is clever enough to know that if he got Alonso, he'd have to win the championship.
Yeah.
It's not on his programme. And Mario Tyson, being very Germanic, is the ultimate strategist. He knows his plan, and he knows when he has to start delivering. Currently, he's over-delivering. Stick Alonso in that car and not win races, which is very likely, and suddenly he's the fall guy.
So, comparisons between Alonso and Montoya in the same car last year.
Well, Alonso's significantly better.
But
Alonso's won three races. Alonso's
is Montoya, or is Alonso feeling the same way that Montoya felt at this point in the season?
No, what Alonso has done is he's thrown his toys out of the pram in a way that has worked at previous teams when they were at the beck and call. He's not been in a situation before where people can actually afford to see him go.
He's no longer racing for a team which is run by his manager.
Well, yeah, also, I mean, in all honesty, obviously, he came in as world champion with a rookie teammate and expected to have a reasonably, trouble-free run to number one. And let's be honest, if we all sat here in March, and the prediction I made was that, Lewis wouldn't win a Grand Prix. He'd do very well, I said, but he wouldn't win a Grand Prix, and I said, hey, Kovalainen and Wood. So he surprised us all, even though we did know that Lewis was good. No one knew he was going to do as well as he was to do out of the box. But I think Alonso has tactically made a mistake, not with what he did in the qualifying, not with how he raced in the race where he got the best result possible from the situation, but with the comments he's made afterwards suggesting publicly he wants to leave. Doesn't do him any good. Does him no good at all. He can phone up Briatore and say, Flavio, see what he can do, because his manager and his manager's got the money. There's no point in making the press start running the argument, because it doesn't help him. It doesn't work in McLaren, because McLaren don't need him.
McLaren, Ron Dennis, in the press since the race, has said he's free to leave at any time.
Well, yes, that's kind of what he would say. I mean, because forced labour is actually illegal in the EEC, so
that's because they don't want to have to pay him off.
Well,
if he leaves, he's got to pay them.
Well, that's it. There's three things that can happen. I know I'm stating the obvious. In 2008, Alonso can drive for McLaren, he can drive for someone else, or he can be told to sit it out, like Alan Prost was. in 92.
But he won't do that. He'll buy himself out of his contract.
Like Jenson Button did.
Yeah, he'll buy himself out of his contract. Yeah, and that's team, what McLaren want to force him to do.
The only team that's gonna, that really, realistically, the only team that's going to sign him is Renault. And one thing Renault don't have is have those big bucks to pay not only the $10 million, $12 million that Alonso will cost them, but also the $10 million, $12 million to buy him out for the year from McLaren.
Would Toyota be interested in Fernando Alonso?
Yes.
Would Fernando Alonso be interested in Toyota? It's a big question.
If he had
would Fabio Briatore be interested in buying Toyota?
I don't know. How do you buy a Toyota? It's a $25 billion organisation. I know he's got some money, but he hasn't got like $100 billion.
Not
the race team.
Toyota, just the race team.
I think not. I think he's exactly where he is.
Well, you see.
What if Renault were to withdraw from Formula One?
Well, that's not going to happen in the next 2 years, at least, not three or four.
Actually, it's more likely that Toyota would go first.
Renault just invested big money in CFD, haven't they? What, $14 or $15 million?
Declan.
Interesting though, isn't it? Because we have this precedent, really, if you look back to Jacques Villeneuve, who left the best team, you know, almost the accusations were that the monkey could have driven that car to win a world championship, and took a moral amount of money to go and race for BAR, which I'm not saying are exactly like Toyota, but that it's not without beyond the bounds of possibility that Toyota could feel that Alonso needs a way out and dangle the biggest contract in the history of Formula One in front of him.
But Captain, what do you think? As Alonso, let's be honest, right? You've already got enough money. You don't need any more money. He's already got $30 or $40 million in the bank. You don't need more than that, whatever you may say. Do you really want to be loved and number one and sucked up to in a car that can finish 10th, or have to fight and scrap with a car that can win?
Well, there have been so many rumours, not just this year, but for the last 3 years maybe, that Briatore was going to take over at Toyota and build the team around his drivers, Alonso and Trulli.
Well, he's fallen out with Trulli about four times.
Yes.
Can't remember his name half the time.
Clarence.
Declan, you have a comment about Mark Webber.
Yes, I'm just thinking of Briatore drivers, and if we were to start the musical chairs now, would Webber not be a good fit under Lewis Hamilton and McLaren?
No.
Why not?
Because he wouldn't win a race.
I hope you didn't say that with an earshot of John.
John wants to say
Gary Paffett,
who we know is not available to McLaren next year because he'll be racing for
Pro Drive. That's he'll be in the car before the end of the season.
There's no way Alonso won't finish the season because of the Constructors' Championship he won.
Puffett's
going. Delarosa can win that races, though.
Puffett's going as a McLaren driver to Pro Drive.
Delarosa, if they have to fill in, they'll fill in when Delarosa writes him.
Yes.
Second and third and get points.
There's another question at this point. With all of this in mind, where is the next Hamilton? Who's the next kid that Ron Dennis has been investing in or McLaren?
Oliver Rowland. John would like to say this. John would like to say Oliver Rowland. Unfortunately, Oliver Rowland is only 14, so it's going to be a while before he gets to
No, but he is the next kid. No. He is on the same type of career development, exactly the same career development as Lewis Hamilton was.
Yeah, but what we're looking at with Lewis Hamilton, we're looking at that generational driver. You're looking at the Prost, the Senna, the Schumacher of their era.
Oliver Rowland isn't that person.
And it's unlikely he may be, but I mean that.
Some people are saying that he's better than Hamilton was at his age.
Yeah, but some people say Heinz-Harl Frentzen was better than Schumacher.
He was.
At one point, but he didn't have
any accidents. He didn't win the Formula One world title.
Ah, but
he didn't win seven of them.
Yeah, but that's not necessarily about. You guys, come on guys, hang on a second, take a reality check here. That's got nothing to do with talent and everything to do with opportunity and money.
Frentzen was at Williams, which was arguably the best
Frentzen
team.
Frentzen was at Williams the year the monkey could win the championship, John.
I think that's a slight on the monkey, to be honest.
He only won one race, and he, whilst I like Heinz an awful lot, you know, the problem is, you know, people will write things and they get taken, but, you know, you only get, if you look at it, it's very, very rare we've had two great drivers at once. I mean, obviously we had Prost and Senna, and I'm trying to think prior to that when it happened. You go through the you know, perhaps Moss and Fangio, you go through the...
How about Mansell and Piquet?
No, they're not the ultimate drivers. The ultimate, if you list the ultimate drivers, you go Fangio, Clark, Prost, Senna, Schumacher, and I would say Hamilton, and those are the guys who are...
And Stewart?
No. sorry that they...
What? What?
No, I mean, we're talking about the absolute top echelon, indisputable rulers of their era.
Oh, Nick, I'm going to have to fight you.
How can Jackie Stewart not be in that?
Because, Jackie Stewart, like Nicky Lauda, like Nelson Piquet, are all, you know, it's levels. I'm trying to think of an analogy. It's like levels. You know, they're very, very good, but they're not...
Not superlative drivers.
As Jackie Stewart would say, then, there's a difference between being great and being one of the greats. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Thank you.
See, I kind of disagree with you on some of those, though, because I don't think Prost... clearly, Prost was very talented, but people don't kind of forget about Prost because he was a bit dull. Now, I never was a Senna fan, but you can't discount the fact that Senna was one of the drivers that was seminal. I don't think he was the best driver around. I think he was probably the most arrogant driver around. It's the same argument with Gilles Villeneuve, isn't it? How can Gilles Villeneuve be the best and he never won anything?
No, but if Gilles Villeneuve is just like Elvis Presley, but you know, anyone who dies young, you know, Kurt Cobain gets overrated just because of the fact they die doing what they do.
Please don't put Gilles Villeneuve in the same category as Kurt Cobain. I still think that you're wrong about Stewart.
Kurt Cobain was much quicker in qualifying, I remember.
Let me know, John. I know this is controversial. If
you're entitled to your opinion.
Gilles Villeneuve hadn't died, yeah? He'd won one world championship in 82 and trundled out, had a nice career, and then hung around the pit lane as dad to Jacques. This whole, you know, loving run by Nigel Roebuck would never have happened.
Well, I've got to tell you, I'm not.
Same thing as Kurt Cobain hadn't shot himself through the head. Nirvana
like
being quite a good band from Seattle, not a seminal band of the 90s.
Well, I don't think they were, but I think Jackie Stewart and Nigel Mansell and Jim Clark and Graham Hill were still tremendous drivers. I hear what you're saying, but I don't subscribe to the fact that there's only one driver for each era, because there's so many factors, particularly nowadays, there's so many factors. Every driver from every era has got to do so many different things from the guys from the years before. And, you know, somebody from 10 years ago who was tremendous in Formula 1 10 years ago would probably be average now, because everything's moving on.
No, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I think if you look at the history of it's very difficult to do direct comparisons, you're right. I mean, it's even, you know, in football it's slightly more easy because you've got pictures of them doing it in a very similar thing. But of course, at this point, it all falls foul because no one actually knows how good the pre-war players were, because we haven't got pictures and the balls are different than they were wearing, and they were wearing, you know, lead weights for boots.
I was talking yesterday to a racing driver. I was talking yesterday to a racing driver who is being advised by someone who was a Formula One world champion and whose father was a Formula One world champion, but in different generations. And he was
That's not
saying,
really very hard to work out, is it?
It's not that hard to work out, no. He was saying that the difference in what he's hearing from the two of them is incredible because of the different generations.
And they're both wrong, because they're both too far removed from it now to have any... It's a bit like having racing drivers as commentators. It's only worth having a racing driver as a commentator, as Damon Hill proved at the weekend, if they have fairly recent knowledge of what they're talking about, or if they have been around it and keep up to date. Because Damon Hill was woeful at the weekend. His driver's knowledge was... And he admitted it himself. You know, when I drove, it was nothing like this. The steering wheel didn't look like that. The cars didn't look like that. They didn't do that. Oh, that's not what I would have done.
Apparently, Lewis Hamilton's father is called Anthony Davidson.
Yes, well, Damon Hill, however, I must make a final point about Damon Hill. Perfect choice for the chairman of the BRDC, given that he's clearly completely out of touch with current motor racing. So, beautiful for the BRDC. Damon, good choice.
So we move on and have some more news, and we move on to A1GP, the World Cup of Motorsport, which has announced its 11-date calendar for 2007 and 2008.
Well, it's actually only 10, isn't there, really? Is a TBA in there?
Well, the date's confirmed. they just haven't confirmed the circuit.
Okay.
So 30th of September at Zandvoort, 14th of October at Brno, 4th of November somewhere in Asia, probably Central, 25th of November Sepang, 16th of December Zhuhai, 20th of January Taupo, 3rd of February Sydney, 24th of February Durban, 16th of March, Mexico City, and before the race at Brands Hatch on the 4th of May, Shanghai was due to be the venue on the 6th of April.
Hang on a second. There's some clashes there, aren't there?
Unfortunately, stands at Shanghai's Grand Prix circuit have been damaged by fierce storms last week and may not be repaired in time for the Formula One race in October, let alone the A1GP race next April.
Oh, that's next October. No.
This October.
Well, no, it's fine. If they're okay by October, they'll be fine for April.
May not be repaired by October.
Yeah, but let's be honest about this. I don't think A1GP troubles that many stands, does it?
I don't think F1 did really, did it?
And it's a capacity of
200,000.
Can we just mention as well that one of those dates clashes with Sebring next year, which is not the same kind of area, but it's not smart. But another one clashes with the British Touring Car Championship.
Yeah, another one clashes with the Race of Champions.
What on earth is it doing carrying on till May?
Well,
they've got to fit all these dates in somewhere. How are they going to run?
There are fewer dates on this calendar than there were on last year.
How are they going to run?
They're doing 3 weeks. It should be concentrated through November, December, January and February.
Nobody wants to race at Christmas, though, do they? Let's move on. We haven't time, John.
A1
Team Lebanon, one of the founding teams of A1 World Cup of Motorsport, has selected Argo Racing as their technical engineering team for this season.
Argo Racing. That's those four-wheel things that the Banana Splits used to run.
Trevor Bale is the...
I've heard of Argo Racing.
Have you?
Yes. The stalwarts of the national scene in the UK.
Ah.
Nick, who runs the... Who's the doctor for the A1GP?
Carlo Van Damme. Carlo Van Damme has done himself a great favour yet again after the Dutchman finished just outside the podium by taking a fourth place at the weekend at the Euro Speedway Lausitz. The Van Amersfoort racing driver dominated in the second race. Van Damme led the race from start to finish, taking his fourth victory of the season in the ATS Formula 3 Cup. The results then in the championship mean that Carlo Van Damme leads with 84 points, Frederik Verwisch is on 71, Nico Bedonks on 63 and Christian Vitoris is on 54. There'll be a new and young name on the Danish Touring Car Championship entry list when the season restarts after the summer break in a week's time. 18-year-old Nicky Thiem from Sonderberg will be making his debut at one of Europe's leading touring car series, where he'll be driving Paulson Motorsports BMW 320 IE90, usually used by his father, Kurt Thiem.
Is that Kurt Thiem's son then?
Yes. Who apparently is from Luxembourg.
No, that's where he lives.
Yes.
I don't think anybody's actually born in Luxembourg.
This year,
I drove across it in 24 minutes.
This year, Nicky Thiem has been driving in Germany. He didn't go through the centre of Luxembourg City because the traffic in there is awful.
And I never exceeded the speed limit.
He takes part in the Seat Leon Supercopa, which is one of the regular DTM support races.
I've had visits to the toilet that were longer than that.
In the championship, he won at Otters Leben and the Norris Ring, and he was also a guest driver at Mugello, where he got the win there, although that was a non-point scoring win.
I should say, dear listener, that Tim is drunk with power this week and has turned everyone else off when he wants to read the news.
That's because you will want to keep talking about things that we don't have time for, because we have one final news story, which may interest either Nick or Damon.
No, that would be the same person.
It would be twice.
Nick or Declan. Immediately after the start of the second GP2 race in Hungary, a disappointed...
Disappointed who?
Hoping... Due to a broken left drive shaft during the first race on Saturday, the Dutch Chinese driver drove a strong race to finish in ninth place, a good position to start.
Is he Dutch or Chinese?
Race from. He's Dutch Chinese.
And Chinese, depending on who you're responsible.
Okay.
It's going for Dutch Chinese means that you order it and then you and your girlfriend have to pay for it. Sorry, carry on.
I think that deserves a round of applause.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you, thank you.
All the week's motorsport news, midweek motorsport on Globecast Radio. If it's happening in motorsport, you'll hear about it on Midweek Motorsport.
Midweek Motorsport.
Globecast Radio's definitive international motorsport magazine show.
Globecast Radio.
The Globecast Radio channel, home of live sports coverage, where it just keeps on coming.
And there we go, the first hour over and done with. How quickly that goes by. And
so quickly.
Still to come then, Tim, in a packed second half.
Your letters, Spanish news here on the Oval with Declan. More here on the Oval with Declan. A new comedy feature and lots more. That's all still to come here on Midweek Motorsport on Globecast Radio.
The Globecast Radio channel, home of live sports coverage, where it just keeps on coming. There's no other channel that fills its airtime with so much coverage of cars and motorsport as Globecast Radio.
Globecast Radio.
Sky Channel 0157 and on the web 0157.org.
Globecast Radio.
Globecast Radio.
Bono extended.
Oh, you've edited the music.
We haven't got time for all of it. I'm proprietary of the Red Bull Racing, Dietrich Marteschitz. Se niego a criticar su equipo por el poco rendimiento que está demostrando en la Formula 1 esta temporada. En su tercera temporada consecutiva en la parrilla, el equipo situado en Milton Keynes está lejos de poder alcanzar los podios regularmente y además ha estado teniendo problemas de fiabilidad con el RB3 de Adrian Newey.
And that's the news in Spanish for this week.
I've also got some sports car news, which I forgot to do earlier.
All right.
Tafel Racing announced today that Nathan Schwarzbau will join team owner Jim Tafel and Dominic Farnbacher in the number 73 Tafel Racing Anchor Tornos Porsche RSR for the American Le Mans Series rounds at Road America, Petit Le Mans and Laguna Seca.
Yeah, that's the team car to Robin Liddell and Wolf Hensler.
And Declan, where will you have found him racing this season?
Oh, that's a good question.
Where have you been obsessed with in our pre-show?
Oh, of course, yes. I'm constantly obsessed with Grand Am. But then again, that's the answer to everything. No matter what American racing driver has at one stage contractually obliged to race at least once in Grand Am this season.
Possibly.
It's interesting that he's been drafted in for Road America, which is, of course, a four-hour race. So he's been drafted in for all the longer races.
Ones.
Stop, oh yes, wait a minute, this is supposed to deliver the letter.
Oh, no, that wasn't very good.
Yes, we now have a vote for Alexis. So, John, is your sack bulging?
My sack was particularly bulging this week, but we're actually very tight for time this week. So just a couple following on from a couple that we had last week. I actually spoke to Sam Collins today, and we will be having a Sam Collins technical feature coming up in the next couple of weeks.
Ooh.
Woo, indeed. So,
can we have a woo from Declan and Nick?
Now, we know that Sam's technical chats do basically promote a lot of letter writing. What we want you to do is preempt that this time, and we'd like you to send in some suggestions as to what technical features Sam should be talking about either next week or the week after. Depends on when we can get him into the studio, because he's a very busy man at Race Car Engineering and he's running the shop at the moment because the boss is away.
Another letter saying, Dear John and Tim, you were right about ethanol, John was wrong.
And who said that?
John.
Yes, thank you. I did send you that and said that E85 was 85% ethanol. I completely... one of the things that people want Sam to talk about is the flashpoints of ethanol fuels, as discussed last week. If you think
that's going to get more listeners than a magic bullet infomercial, isn't
it? No, not at all. Yeah, probably will if Sam's talking about it. Studio at 0157.org. We will have a full letters feature next week. Doug Verner has sent us a tremendous missive as well, which we have to hold over because we simply don't have time to do it justice this week. Plenty to talk about though, and as there's no F1 this weekend, that means that we have plenty of time to talk about it next week here on Midweek Motorsport on the letters page, studio at 0157.org.
News from across the pond. If it happens over there, hear about it over here on Midweek Motorsport.
And that usually signifies the appearance once again of Declan Brennan.
Well, I'm not actually going to appear because that would be rather remarkable. But I am.
The radio, it would, yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
It's a very non-visual medium.
It certainly is. How are you, sir?
I'm a little sunburnt, as you may have heard earlier on in the show.
You see, that doesn't happen to me because I can't actually go out into natural sunlight without walking through a sheep dip of factor 30 at the very least, on account of my ludicrously blue Irish skin. So
yes.
So I tend not to go out even when it's hot. So I don't really worry about such things. I just tend to stay in. So therefore, in the summer when TV ratings go down all over the world for various reasons.
Yours don't.
Yeah, exactly. They, I often wonder, who are the people staying indoors? They're people like me, or mainly me.
Let's start with some pointless American press release.
Excellent, yes. Well, I have to say, you're clearly expanding, because normally your pointless press releases come from British Formula Junior teams. Or
they usually come from Belgium.
Or post-historic road sports.
They usually come from Belgium. Oh,
fair enough. Well, this is interesting because I think I have a teeny inkling based on the fact that we did have a little chat before and that I think I might know what this would be about. And Belgium could be significant.
Conquest Racing is proud to welcome Voxdale, a Belgian engineering firm with their headquarters in Antwerp, to the Champ Car World Series. In this high level of international motorsport competition, Voxdale and Conquest Racing will be working together through their new technical partnership focusing on racing technologies. Voxdale will implement its aerodynamic and structural simulation tools for the further development of the team's Champ Car DP01 chassis. Hang on, are they allowed to develop the chassis, Declan?
I read the press release earlier, and that's the first thing that went through my mind. I thought, hang on, this is a spec series. Unless I'm very much mistaken, and I'm sure somebody who loves Champ Car far more than all of us put together will send us an email and say, yes, they are actually allowed to do that. But this is one of the more pointless press releases you've ever read out. This is a local Belgian technology company jumping on board, a team with a half Belgian owner. No, the team is half owned by a Belgian. He's not a half.
Eric Bachelot is fully Belgian.
Yes, he certainly is. He's not half Belgian anyway, he's fully Belgian. It's all a Belgian technology love-in. That's what it is. And it's of absolutely no interest to consumers in the grand scheme of things in any way, shape or form. But well done them for Conquest Racing for finding somebody to give them $30 or $40 for the race. So,
Jan Heyden is, I think, the first Belgian to race for Conquest Racing, though, is he not?
Now, I'm quite surprised there, because I was fairly sure Jan Heyden was the Dutch formerly Atlantic champion, who wasn't Belgian at all, but I might be wrong.
That was Charles Wolfsman.
Ah, yes, it was, yes. Now, you see, that's, again, one of the problems imagine the problem with US single C-seater racing being the fact that there are too many people from the Benelux in it. Years ago, it was Arie Luyendyk, who had somehow managed to remove all the Benelux-ness from him, and he was very much an American with his big hair. But now it's just full of them. We're swimming. Can't turn in Atlantics or Champ Car for Dutchmen and Belgians.
This is something we spoke to Robert Dunbos about earlier as well.
Yes. Well, but we do like him, as we said.
Christophe Tanso is French. Felipe Giafone was...
He was Brazilian.
Christian Colby is Danish.
Yes, Christian Colby, very familiar Christian Colby, he began a trend of Duckens, Van Diemen, works drivers not to do anything in their future careers. There used to be a time when if you drove the Duckens, Van Diemen, you were pretty much guaranteed to have a fairly decent career, including one Marcus Ambrose, who we get onto later on.
But Colby didn't. Wesley Barber famously didn't.
Yes.
And I believe Jan Heyden drove for Van Diemen when he was in British Formula Ford.
Ah, but was it in the blue and yellow Duckens, Van Diemen? That's very important.
I seem to think it was.
Because Eddie Irvine dominated in the Duckens, Van Diemen for many, many years.
Nelson Felipe
Sorry, can I just clarify what I just said? He didn't dominate in the Ducum van Diemen for many, many years. That would mean he was constantly racing in Formula Ford, which is utterly not true.
He dominated for a season.
Yes, he did. Sorry, carry on.
Nelson Felipe.
Tell me what's happened to him, because he's dropped off the radar. He has a very nice girlfriend, and I'm sure has dumped him now that he doesn't have a job.
I've no idea what happened to him, but he did race for Conquest Racing in 2004.
Well, he did. Well, I think the poor fella landed Miss Gold Coast Grand Prix and then lost his ride. So I don't know if she's going to be still interested in him. I'm not sure how interested Beauty Queens are in former racing drivers.
Yes.
But he certainly had the talent, and he began to show it last year. And then as the subsidies for the various rides disappeared, we lost people like him and Andrew Ranger and various other people. But did he race a Works Van Diemen, did you say?
No, he didn't. He raced for Conquest.
Ah, right.
I'm struggling to think of anyone else who...
Mario Hartlepool raced for Conquest.
He did. Did he race for Van Diemen?
I don't think he did.
He did British Formula 4. He did Formula 3.
Yes. Mario Hartlepool raced when they were MyJack Conquest.
Yes, his, as did Justin Wilson.
Yes.
Both of them raced alongside each other in Formula 3000.
They did. Justin Wilson proving to be the better at then, and probably still is now.
Yes.
Did anybody
beat Wilson in Formula 3, though?
He did. Did Mario Hartlepool also beat Enrico Bernaldi that year?
I think everyone beats Enrico Bernaldi that
year. We're talking about Mario Hartlepool is obviously with the Conquest connection, but again, where has he gone?
Let's ask Nick Damon later on.
Yes, let's do. Please, keep me on the line when Nick arrives, if you can. And I want to find out what he knows about Mario Hartlepool. I would have expected, everybody else who has a modicum of talent who can't get a drive in anything to end up driving in one of the 4,000 Daytona prototypes that keep turning up every week for Grand Am. But honest to goodness, I know we've gone off topic and we will get back in a second, but did you watch the Grand Am from Montreal?
I tend not to watch Grand Am. I just don't have enough time.
No, I don't have enough. I don't have enough will to live to watch Grand Am either. The chassis.
You could go and enjoy the sun.
That's very true. But then I would have burnt to death, and that wouldn't be a good thing. So it was Grand Am or nothing, unfortunately.
And now on Globecast on Motorsport Soap, a new life in Evenham.
It's been a while since we've played this bit of music on Midweek Motorsport.
You know what? I always know when we're struggling for content of the week when you play the full version of the theme music to our new life in Evernham. And by the way, I can't believe you cut me off so sharply when I was having a rant about Daytona prototypes, but never mind.
It was... we played the full version because we've got a lot of Evernham news.
Oh, yes. Go on, then.
Starting off with the news that... they've decided to temporarily drop one of their drivers.
Well, yes. Not a cheap drop. It's more, he hasn't been dropped, put it this way, he's been substituted tactically.
Tactical substitution.
Yes.
And we'll come on to those later on as well.
Well, do we want to talk about that now, or are we going to talk about the big news
The big news, presumably, is that they have reached a one-race agreement with Patrick Carpentier to drive the number 10 Valvoline Stanley Tools Dodge at Watkins Glen this weekend.
Yes. That is on the back of his excellent performance, second-place performance in Canada in the Bush race.
And he started from pole.
Yes, he did. And just in case anybody any of our seven fans are waiting to get our take on the Bush race, that is coming. It'll be a little bit later because that obviously deserves probably a one-hour special on itself. It was such an extraordinary event. But he stuck it on pole. He was tremendous.
and in the race drove beautifully to second, and clearly thought second was justified him staying on the front stretch to do donuts and burnouts with the other two people ahead of him. And of course, if you don't know, we will get to why there was two people ahead of him later. So we had a very surreal situation where we had several people doing donuts and burnouts for various reasons after the Bush race. But to cut a long story short, he had an absolutely cracking race. A light clearly went off in Ray Evernham's head because he suddenly decided, yes, Scott Riggs is really pretty woeful on these type of tracks. And he's a couple of places outside the top 35 in owner points, and I need somebody who can, at Watkins Glen, get us back into the top 35. I know, Carpentier looks like he's quite good. So they've signed him up for a one-race deal. So he's going to run the Valvoline car.
Now, his Bush debut last weekend wasn't his first stock car race, was it?
No, he's been running. He's become quite a nomadic driver recently. He's been running in CAFCAR, in Canadian stock car racing, along with the likes of Andrew Ranger and one or two others. Well, obviously several others, because they don't just have a field of four. That'd be ridiculous. But so he's been running in CAFCAR. He's been running in, as I said earlier, one of the many people who can't get a drive in anything proper. So he's been running in Daytona Sports prototypes as well. So he really did impress. The cynics will say that, it's funny how in practice a Canadian with a high profile ends up on pole position for a Canadian-based race. But he was excellent, and he showed his speed and his ability to drive these things. Because it's a long race. That's a long, it's a 73-lap race. And forgive my ignorance, but how long is the F1 race there?
About 60.
Right, and about the same, if not less, for the champ cars are an hour and a half, so there'll be even less for the champ cars. So that was a long race in a big, heavy car, and a big, heavy, hot car. So very, very good performance by him. And he's won himself a chance to become one of the, potentially become one of the regular road course specialists for one of the established teams, which is about to become even more established as we move on to the next part of the story.
He could be Scott Pruitt, couldn't he?
He could be, yes, that's exactly what he could be. Scott Pruitt is obviously tied into Ganassi Racing. That's effectively his job now, is to tutor the drivers on road courses, to race on road courses as well, and then obviously to run in Ganassi's, his Daytona prototype team.
You will keep going back to Daytona prototype, not talking about Grand Am.
It does seem to be sort of some sort of, you don't go to
the... It's the missing link.
Yeah, it's not the scrap heap anymore. You just have to go and race in Daytona prototype.
It's the Da Vinci Code of motorsport.
It's the dinner theatre circuit of motorsport, is Daytona prototype. When you end up in Vegas playing in small bars, that is exactly what Daytona prototype is.
Same with Evernham Motorsports. Outside investors are increasingly finding a new home inside the NASCAR Nextel Cup, and George Gillette Jr., the owner of the Montreal Canadiens and also a half owner of Liverpool, is the latest to buy in.
Yes, well, we have talked about this on more than one occasion, that despite the evidence to the contrary, the fact that the level of evolution in a stock car and an engine is so minimal, that you think you wouldn't need to necessarily invest that much to make them go quick. The fact is that the money and the fractions of seconds that separate the grid means that the amount of investment needed to move 20, 30 places up the grid is phenomenal. A lot of it is down to aero now, which means you have to have a wind tunnel. And if you're some teams, you have secret test tunnels in Pennsylvania and all sorts of things that we can't talk about. But everybody is looking for finance. We look at the Gin Racing DEI merger, which of course isn't a merger, it was really a takeover. We look at Jack Roush getting money from the Fenway Group organization and becoming Roush Fenway Racing. This is happening more and more.
Richard Childress Racing has Chartwell Investments as owners. Robert Yates and Newman Haas Lanigan.
Absolutely, and don't forget Richard Childress Racing and DEI have also pooled resources on their engine program.
So this is happening more and more. It also is gradually eroding the size of the grid. We may get to a stage in the next few years. I think it will happen where, you know, they are just about getting 43 entries on the grid. There won't be the extras purely because the cost of entry level costs are just rising rapidly. Therefore, people like Evernham's, even with the money from Dodge dealers, and they're getting a contribution from every Dodge dealer in the country for that program. That isn't enough. They've got all of Valvoline's money. Valvoline's money isn't enough. They need extra investment, and that's what they've gone out to get. So, I haven't got the figures in front of me, but it's a substantial investment. It will be similar to the type of investment which the Fenway Group put into Roush Racing, which was about, off the top of my head, about $50 million.
Yeah, and that was just for a 50% stake.
Mm-hmm.
The next one, according to rumours, is Petty Enterprises. Richard Petty's saying he's looking for adding partners.
Yeah. See, with Petty, and I think with Richard Petty, the idea of losing the Petty Enterprises name is I don't think that would be entertained by anybody in the Petty family. The problem with Petty Enterprises is they haven't been competitive for a very long time. Even putting a very fast veteran like Bobby Labonte in a 43 car hasn't really made that much difference. He's occasionally troubled the upper echelons of the grid, and his finishing positions have been pretty okay. In fact, the fact is he's 20th in the championship, which for Petty Enterprises isn't that bad at all. Kyle, due to an inspired field strategy, got a top three at the Coca-Cola 600 this year, but that really has been the highlight of pretty much the last decade for this. So they haven't really done much. In fact, I'm looking at the points here now, and Kyle is 37th. In fact, Scott Riggs has moved up one. He's 36th. I did say he was 37th. Scott Riggs is 36th. Kyle Petty is 37th. Kyle has one top 10 this year. And that was actually a top 5.
It's not great. So that's teams like JTG Racing. What's going to happen to them?
You know, you could go through the list, so like Furniture Row and them, and you know, I think what's going to happen is people are going to get absorbed. They're going to have to. Smaller teams, people like Robbie Gordon is going to, and some of the teams you mentioned, and others are just going to have to start to look for mergers. I know Robbie Gordon was one of the reasons he went to Ford. Is I think there was the potential that Gordon and Yates were going to merge last year. Yates now have this slightly unusual marriage of convenience with Newman Hannes Lanigan, which does help them in some ways, and we've yet to see where the full benefit of that is going to come for both parties, although really it's fundamentally, as we said last week, it's an interesting marriage to allow Kyle Kristoloff to run and to develop a program that will get him into Nextel Cup in the very near future. It's really difficult to know. I think we will see teams disappear. I think we'll see teams move down to Busch. I think the changes in the Busch rules that might come might actually help, because they're talking about changing the shape of the cars completely. You might even see teams move down to ARCA. ARCA might you know, begin to have a little bit of a resurgence as costs increase. It's just difficult to know. But we are definitely seeing a consolidation that is going to continue for a long time. And unfortunately, the days of parity and the days of being able to say that, you know, 43 cars turn up and any one of them can win, as well, we know they've been gone for a while, but they aren't coming back, put it that way.
What do the people who run NASCAR think about all this? Because it's only a couple of years since they were trying to restrict the number of cars a single team could run.
I think they've successfully done that, haven't they? That is another reason for this type of partnership. So teams like, for example, Sobey, you know, No Fear Racing can come in and use pretty much, and we discussed this, last year, they can use massive amounts of facilities from Jack Roush. They can run independently, but effectively they can run, and it allows Jack Roush to develop both his engineering talent, his, you know, potential. I wouldn't say Boris said he's been developed as talent, but there'll be opportunities with that team, you know, and others like them to sort of almost under the guise of a satellite operation to a Scuderia Toro Rosso, if you will. I think that's the way things are going to go. We're going to see more of that. So you never know. No Fear Racing next year might almost effectively be Roush light.
Okay.
I think that's going to happen more and more. And, you know, it happens. If you were to watch, last week there was an absolutely fantastic ARCA race. That's one of the reasons I get to watch these, because when the sun is out, I can't go out. So I've just got to watch lots and lots of motorsport. There was a terrific ARCA race at one of the support races at Pocono. And just as an aside, we're not going to talk too much about the actual race this year because it was utterly dull. We'll get back to that later in terms of who won and what it does to the points chase and stuff. But it was mega tedious. The cracking ARCA race. And the ARCA field at the front now is becoming... It's a bit like... and for all of our English listeners, they'll understand this. ARCA is a bit like Division 2 or the recently Division 3, the old Division 4. Maybe the better comparison is ARCA is like...
It's like the MLS.
No. Better comparison would be ARCA is like the best minor league baseball is AAA, then it goes AA. ARCA is like single-A or double-A baseball. It's full of people who are being developed, in many cases, being developed for the top teams. There are development programs all over the place in ARCA. And it's now, the whole thing is, it's the ABC program. It's the ARCA Busch Cup program. In fact, the winner last week was a name you might be familiar with, a young man called Michael McDowell, who did two Champ Car races a couple of years ago and looked like he was going to have a terrific career in single-seaters. And then money ran out and his options disappeared. And he ended up, he's now running an ARCA team and he's becoming a star of ARCA and another very good young single-seater mouse in single-seater racing lost the stock cars. So, but as I was saying, ARCA is just full of development programs from Evernham's, from Roush, from Richard Childress Racing, you name it. So that's going to continue and you'll probably see those teams develop as well. So it's a case of we'll probably end up with almost like Major League Baseball. They never want to use the word franchise in NASCAR, but there'll be super teams and their development programs will just permeate down right through, as they do already, through the Busch Series, through Truck, through ARCA and Sprint Cars.
Could we get to a situation, though, where effectively there is one team for each manufacturer and they just run under lots of different names?
That's an interesting thought. I don't think that will happen, no. I think because of the way the manufacturers like to work and the way that the manufacturer model is slightly different. It's more a case of producing a spec and then the manufacturers basically putting money into specific teams. Like they've always been heavily Ford have been a favourite for years. And no, I don't think it's a case of them running. I don't think it defeats the purpose slightly. I think the separate teams, the model they have now seems to work. I think NASCAR want to restrict it, though. They don't want to end up with 8 Roush cars on the track, even though there's the potential for that to happen, as he said, in other ways, whether it be a Roush B team or... But it'll have to be clever how the ownership works. For example, Hendrick could expand more, but then what he'd probably have to do is they'd probably have to funnel off the cars owned by Jeff Gordon and other members of the Hendrick family into a separate group. So it's just it's all a bit of a charade, really, because nothing is going to stop this onward march where money and you know that level of investment is going to dictate who's going to win, and that's going to happen. The days of guys, almost the days of what David Gilliland did in Busch Series last year, those days are that's the last I think we'll ever see of that. The last we'll see of somebody arriving at a track, you know, like Skid Solo with one mechanic. You know, with the car on the back of a trolley, those days are gone. David Gilliland is probably the last time that will ever happen.
Okay, well, let's return to the Canadian Busch race that we touched on earlier on. And where do you want to start?
Well, I could start at the start, but I
think...
Do you want to go back and go and talk about qualifying?
No, I don't think we really just... We should get to the last five laps of the most barking race in the history of the world. I do want to say something, though.
Can I just interrupt here quickly? Listeners, please bear in mind that Declan's description of the last five laps is likely to take longer than the actual last five laps.
Yes, absolutely. First of all, before we get to that, I did something I'm contractually obliged to do as a correspondent for this program, which was I was about half an hour from Montreal on the other side of the Canadian border over the weekend, but didn't get to the race. So that sort of ticks that box of me hanging around near where major events are happening. I let myself down very badly by actually going to New Hampshire and to Lime Rock. Obviously, that was very bad, but I've sorted it out by not going to Montreal, but being very close.
But to be fair, when you went to Lime Rock, you had been planning to go to a different event altogether.
That's very true. Yes, and we'll get back more of that later, or some other time. So, we had this, you know, a packed house, a fabulous event for the fans, a huge crowd. But before I get to that, I did pick up some of the race on the radio while I was driving around Lake Champlain in northern Vermont, and I noticed that MRN do exactly the same as they do, and you'll be familiar with this. You being the broadcast expert, you might want to explain to our loyal listener how MRN tend to core oval races.
They generally have one person at turn one, one person at turn two, one person at turn three, and one person at turn four. And they each talk for 10 seconds or so, depending on how fast the lap is. And once each person's had a chance to speak, then they go to commercials for 6 minutes.
Right. So, how many corners are there at the Circuit Gilles Villeneuve?
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, possibly nine if you include that little left-hand kink. 10, 11, I make it 12.
Right. How many announcers, and this is commentators, that we're used to having two on a Grand Prix, you might be looking at two and one guy in the pits. How many people do you think they had?
Well, it's not going to be 12. That would be too obvious.
I have to apologise. They had one for every corner, and they would have had extra people, so they had at least 12.
Right.
It's absolutely, without question, the most ludicrous broadcast I've ever heard in my life.
It dates back, presumably, from the time when you didn't have TV pictures and you couldn't see the whole track, and therefore you needed someone in every part of the track. The same used to happen on horse racing. You'd have one person covering the start of the race, and then they'd hand over to another person for the middle of the race.
Yeah, which they still do for the Grand National.
They still do it on the Grand National. They have four or five commentators for the Grand National.
But they're
talking very, very fast, and the race only lasts 7 minutes.
Yeah, it's only a two-lap race, the Grand National. It's not 76 laps. You know, it was just remarkable, absolutely remarkable, and completely pointless. And God bless MRN, because they're clearly making far too much money in sponsorship and commercials to not send that many people to the race. It was just was ludicrous.
They make up 80% of their output, don't they? So.
The point is, before we get to the extraordinary finish, can I just say, all Busch series, regular Busch series and Nexo Cup racers, for the most part, you must hang your heads in shame. You are a disgrace to motor racing. A disgrace. The reason I say that is, for huge chunks of the race, the top 10 in that race was made up of either ringers or regular Busch series racers who have come from road racing.
There was one exception, though, wasn't there? He did quite well, didn't he?
Go on, play it.
Was there not a point when you thought Harvick might win this race?
No, not ever.
Oh.
There was never a time when I thought Kevin Harvick was going to win it. But then again, that happens a lot with Kevin Harvick. If you think about back to the Daytona 500 this year, where he came from 65th with half a lap to go to win. So, he came from literally from the slingshot from the car park. So he's very good at this. But this was not a race I expected a oval Nextel Cup stroke Busch Series regular to win, if it wasn't Marcus Ambrose or Robbie Jordan, for example. As I said, it was dominated for the most part by a list of drivers up the front, including Robbie Jordan, Marcus Ambrose, Ron Fellows, Boris Sedd, Patrick Carpentier,
Scott Pruitt,
Max Pappas, and guess who was racing, Britain's own, Northampton's own Andy Pilgrim racing for Junior Motorsport, would you believe?
Wow.
Andy Pilgrim, 50-year-old Andy Pilgrim. Anyway, so I will cut straight to the last five laps. There's a yellow flag period, which the restart is with about five laps to go. Marcus Ambrose and Robbie Jordan in the lead. They get through the first corner safely. Then all hell breaks loose. Kevin Harvick deliberately, and it's important to say this for later on, deliberately in my eyes, I can't see how it could have been any other way, deliberately punts Scott Pruitt off at the first part of the long right-hander, which is effectively that complex, which is the first corner in Montreal. Punts him off, causes chaos, literally blocks the field in a classic, speaking of the Grand National, imagine Finehaven when he stopped at that fence and the whole field, the whole field was stuck at the fence and Finehaven went on to win. This is pretty much what happened. The whole track was blocked by Robbie Jordan and Marcus Ambrose. The yellow flags immediately come out. We cut to those two guys racing. They haven't seen the yellows. They race through the short chute up to the next corner. Robbie takes the lead. And then through that right-left kink, Ambrose punts him from behind, spins him round, and goes on. Right, hold that thought. The yellows are out. The field is frozen at this point. Arguably, if sense probably prevails, what should have happened was Marcus Ambrose should have been given, should have been in the lead. Robbie Jordan should have been second.
Okay.
NASCAR, in their wisdom, decided that Robbie Jordan should restart 13th.
Right.
Because he didn't maintain, the correct speed behind the pace car.
They've been taking advice on grid positioning from the FIA, haven't they?
Yes, absolutely. Just randomly, basically, they just threw a dart in the NASCAR Hall. They threw a promotional dart into a board and came up with 13th position for him. To cut a long story short, Robbie Jordan said, bleep that for a game of soldiers. I'm going to start where I think I should, which is at the front. So the race went to a green-white checker. The race started into the first corner. Robbie Jordan immediately punted Marcus Ambrose off the track.
Okay.
Immediately. He kept going. He went on. Kevin Harvick was in second place after they sorted out that melee. Kevin Harvick was in second. He went round. Robbie Jordan was in the lead.
Carpentier, wasn't he?
He was. Carpentier was behind him. Harvick was given the win, which is quite remarkable. We had the bizarre sight then of both Robbie Jordan and Kevin Harvick doing burnouts in front of the crowd, celebrating the win. Robbie Jordan knew exactly what was going to happen. He knew he was going to, but he decided he was right, and the only thing he could do was race under protest, which you don't really get to do in NASCAR. This is a very unusual situation. And the problem was, really, the incident raised more questions than answers, because they said he passed under the yellow, which he did, but Marcus Ambrose clearly passed back under the yellow in the first incident. Arguably, you could have knocked them both back. Kevin Harvick absolutely deliberately punted Scott Pruitt off, and the fact that he started the melee that caused all of this and then went on to win is just almost incomprehensible. But it really is one of those things that the depending on who you like and, whether you're a NASCAR fan of the rules or you're a fan of Marcus, I felt really sorry for Marcus Ambrose because it wasn't necessarily his fault. And I'm a big Robbie Gordon fan, as you well know. And but I thought he really did the wrong thing. That's one of those things where you just have to. NASCAR aren't the sort of organisation who allow you to compete under protest, or if you do, are going to change their minds. And they certainly didn't. So, in fact, they did more than that. They benched Robbie Gordon for the race in Pocono the following day. The team had to put PJ Jones in the car. So
he was probably just there.
Yes, exactly.
Since last year.
Yes. So just an absolutely astonishing race. Actually, a pretty good race. It was actually a pretty good race, but the finish just eclipsed everything. And we have the situation where I'd imagine everybody who is there has already bought their tickets for next year. You know, as much as NASCAR gets to flex their muscle and bench Robbie Gordon for a race, you know that themselves and Norman Legault, the promoter up there, are secretly laughing up their sleeves because they really know they hardly have to sell any tickets for next year. They'll all be sold.
Okay, Declan, we'll come back to you a little later in the program to talk about a different oval race. In fact, an oval race. But for now, that's the first part of the Ear on the Oval.
News from across the pond. If it happens over there, hear about it over here on Midweek Motorsport.
Now, this bit of music is to introduce our brand new feature, which starts this week and may appear occasionally.
Okay.
Whenever someone reports back.
Okay.
This may require quite a bit of audience interaction.
Oh, dear.
Over the last week, since we did the last episode of Midweek Motorsport, I've been very busy. I've been travelling all over Europe and have spent a lot of nights in bars.
Right.
So what's the change from normal?
Sorry, Nick.
He normally has a very quiet life, Nick. You should know that.
Yeah, that's it.
Right. Okay. So you're spending bars.
I was talking to a young lady that I met in one of these bars.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to the subject of Max Pappas.
Yes.
The subject of Max Pappas.
Right.
And that brings us on to our new feature, which is called Magnus Major Maximus.
Yes.
This young lady, it appears, has seen various racing drivers of various nationalities in a state of undress.
Right.
She sounds classy.
Yes. This is going to run and run, this one. And apparently she was comparing different Scandinavian drivers.
Right.
Right, okay. Are you sure there's no chance of being sued or
we're not going to mention any names.
Okay, right.
Okay.
The driver from Norway was big.
Mm.
The driver from Finland was bigger.
Yeah.
And the driver from Sweden was actually very small.
Ah. And
right.
How do people get involved with this? Do we want them to email us?
Anyone who's listening and has seen a naked racing driver,
mm-hmm.
Let us know his nationality and...
You can put his name in, we'll disguise it, obviously. We'll change the name to protect the embarrassed.
Yes.
Hmm. And the bragging, obviously.
I've seen Brian Close naked, if that's any help.
No.
All right.
Not the racing driver.
That's studio@0157.org for... what do you call it?
Magnus Major Maximus.
I can't think of a Swedish racing driver.
Tim, I actually have one. I've just realised that I have seen Ari Vatanen naked. I've shared a sauna with him.
He's a rally driver.
You now can't say anything.
You can't mention anything now, Dex, because otherwise, you know, that would be, you know... You can say that, yes. You can't sweat and tell, I'm afraid. That's studio@0157.org, and it requires your input. Major
Magnus Major Maximus.
Okay. I think I went to school with him. It's Midweek Motorsport.
I think he's doing the Brazilian Touring Car Championship, isn't he?
It's Midweek Motorsport on a Wednesday night. This may be our last show.
News from across the pond. If it happens over there, hear about it over here on Midweek Motorsport.
We return to our Ear on the Oval segment, part two. If you remember, if you're listening to part one earlier in the show, Declan Brennan wanted to know from Nick Damon, what's happened to Mario Haberfelt and Enrique Benoldi? Nick Damon.
Enrique Benoldi is doing one of those Brazilian... I'm not sure what he's doing. I think he's doing the Brazilian touring cars.
Right.
Mario Haberfelt, brilliant question. Don't know. Because he was... he went all the way to 3,000 on the back of a good F3 career and then really got lost in 3,000. You all know his team. He was a good team, wasn't he?
He was with Aston Martin.
And he had Andy Miller engineering him, so there was absolutely no reasons for it. But he just never made that step up. I mean, it's interesting. I think we've got a... obviously, while Declan's here, I was looking at the GP2 over the weekend, and the only thing I can draw a conclusion from GP2 is that Antonio Pizzonia really is crap.
Well, I'm going to drive again. I'm running sacked.
Well, no, because Adam Carroll took over his car.
Oh, yes,
and he's now won twice, been the podium, I think, two other times. So, quite frankly, why on earth are they actually giving cash to Antonio Pizzonia? I have no idea at all.
But you know what? Nick, that is an absolute mystery because, and we've said this on more than one occasion, he flew in testing.
He can test. He can't race. He can test.
Well, why did surely he's right to be a permanent tester then with somebody?
Well, yeah, I mean, but I suppose the only place where you get paid to be a tester is F1. F1 want their test drivers to be able to race occasionally.
He did test for Williams for a while, didn't he?
Well, he tested for Williams, and he, a long time ago, did some testing for Renault, and he was, obviously he ran for Jaguar.
Yeah, and attempted to kill all the journalists that covered them.
Right, but he just never had he just couldn't, out of F3, he just never had his head right, and I think, you know, yeah, as we've seen this weekend, having your head right is very important.
And put it this way, he went to the cut and thrust and the highly competitive world of Champ Car last year, and really wasn't very good in that either.
No, once again he started to deceive. Didn't he put in a couple of reasonable performances, didn't he, at the start of the season? And everyone, yes, it's the renaissance of Mr. Pizzonia, and then it just disappeared up his own backside. It normally does.
What do people can do now for a living?
You can be a retired racing driver, can't you, and do promotional opportunities and open supermarkets or petrol stations, probably petrol stations for him.
And you see, that'll be a problem for him in Brazil, because doesn't Pedro Diniz's dad own all the supermarkets in Brazil? Which means Pedro Diniz would probably be the first driver.
His empire was in Italy.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
All right. So
was, being the operative word.
He managed to sell a lot of Parmalat milk, though, didn't he?
Yeah.
So the problem, I couldn't make any money, and then went bang, and then which was, that was a disaster, but it was a particular disaster for Niki Lauda because he lost his hat sponsor.
He found a selection of new hat sponsors, all of which have been more lucrative than the previous one. Can we go back to IndyCar racing and talk about Sarah Fisher, who must obtain medical clearance from Dr. Michael Olinger at Kentucky before she's allowed to race?
Well, she's not the only one, let me say. This is, this is not too unusual an occurrence, but it is important to say that, you know, and no apologies to Sarah Fisher, but there is one other person who probably more significantly also needs medical clearance.
Helio Castroneves.
Yes.
The difference between them was that Castroneves injured his knee by crashing into Vitor Mera, whereas Sarah Fisher just had a car which fell apart around her.
But the problem with I think we really should address the Castroneves issue first. I don't know if he did it deliberately to mask the fact that it was completely his fault. But Castroneves got out of the car after the accident, where he clearly moved up into Vitor Mera. And it was the best television I've seen in a long time. He got out of the car, and this, you know, comedy little man with his big helmet walked away. At one stage, I'm sure Penske were fuming because he walked back to the garage and I had a long shot of him. He was shouting at himself the entire way. At one stage, he tried to smash his hands device on the ground. He was so angry. And I'm pretty sure that the captain would rather he didn't smash a $4,000 piece of safety equipment in anger.
It's like a Bakelite cravat, isn't it?
Oh, don't tell John you got that one in.
Milka Duno and John Herb, who?
Milka Duno effectively has been benched for running out of talent, which is, she literally has been told, she's under probation, they're now going to look at every single action that she does on the racetrack is going to be scrutinised before she's let out to race again.
She, on the official results, she's got a little star by her name. I don't know what that means because it doesn't say, but the only other person with a little star by his name is Ryan Hunter-Reay.
Can we just stop there for two seconds, and I want to bring Nick in on this. Can we just stop there? What an indictment of American racing that somebody with Ryan Hunter-Reay's talent is tootling around in some piece of junk in the middle of an IRL field.
Yeah, but the problem is that, you know, IRL, not wishing to be cruel, is a piece of junk.
Yes, absolutely.
And in all honesty, not wishing to be too cruel, I don't particularly think that Kart is much better. And as unfortunately, as the years go on and the split gets wider, it appears they're both going downhill. What you would expect to normally happen in any situation in business, that one of them would rise to the top and usurp the other one, but they appear just to be dragging each other down to quicksand. And Dario might win the IndyCar championship this year, and you think, well, whoopee-doo, what have you beaten?
You know, the problem as well is Nick, that it's not even a case of that if one beats the other off and then one disappears, the other will leap triumphantly to the top of the television ratings and going, ha-ha, we're back. By the time one has eaten the other, there will be nothing left for anybody to watch because they're not watching it now. You know, the combined TV audiences don't...
Well, wasn't it you who spouted this rumour you'd heard only about 7 or 8 weeks ago where it said the only way it's going to save single-seater racing is the France organisation set their own one up and start again?
No, that wasn't me, but you know what?
That was John, I think.
Unfortunately, it sounds like a pretty decent solution. But the problem is, look at their sports car series. It's shameful. And then we have
back to Daytona prototype.
But look at it. It's appalling. It's appalling. The cars look disgusting. There's 60 of them on the grid because they're 80 pence to build. You know, they sound awful. It's just, that's a dreadful series.
Does anyone want a Mario Harbourfield update?
Yes, good man.
Last year, he was in Grandam with Adrian Fernandez. And I can't read Portuguese, but this year, I think he's a driver coach in Formula BMW United States.
Oh, fantastic.
That actually does ring a bell to me. I do remember seeing a press release to that effect in English. Can we go back to the IndyCars again?
Well, can I go back to Schroeder? Can I just check? Enrico Bernoldi is doing Brazilian touring cars. Is that the same thing that Galter Sales and Gaston Mazzacane are doing?
No, there are two very high-profile series in South America. One is Argentinian touring cars, and the other is Brazilian stock cars.
Right.
Both of them run in both Brazil and Argentina. The Argentinian touring cars are silhouettes of things like, you know, things like Chevys, but not like the world touring cars. I mean, the silhouette's much more flexible. And the Brazilian stock cars are, it's hard, I'm trying to think what they're most like. They're probably most like something you would say, I think Dunlop supercars, but on steroids, you know what I mean, Tim?
Ah, yes.
Whereas the touring car, the Argentinian touring cars are actually based on a car.
I need to add at this stage quickly, just before we get back to the IndyCars, and I do apologise for this, but something that is relevant to Brazil and oval racing and Nick being the Grand Prix correspondent. We must talk, and please tell me, you already talked about it, I do apologise. Nelson Piquet going back to, have you talked about Nelson Piquet going back to driver's head?
We haven't,
head?
No.
We did last week.
That was last week in the Spanish news.
Because they've had. I've just seen the footage. The footage made the TV in the Speed TV in the US of him sitting sheepishly in the front seat at the front of the classroom with the, like, watching the 60-year-old man pointing at how to go around the corner properly, and it was just fantastic.
Tony Kanaan was the winner, wasn't he, Declan?
One of the driver's ed, Clara, don't you?
I'm trying to get you back on topic before we run out of time.
I tell you, if you watched the highlights on SportsCenter, you wouldn't know who the winner was, because as soon as Danica Patrick, she finished third. I think we're allowed to call her name for a third place finish.
She finished seventh, Declan.
She did, sorry, she was in third, so you're right, I can't. Mrs. Hospital, was in contention and then had the deflating rear tyre and went into the pits. So they basically showed her pit stop, and they showed, with subtitles, her saying, "It's the worst nightmare of my life. Oh no, it's terrible. I haven't got a chance to win. Everybody hates me."
Why did they show up with subtitles? Was she speaking in some kind of foreign language?
Well, she was speaking into the radio, and just in case people were hard of hearing.
It's a nightmare.
With such small audiences, they have to cater for every last one of them. I'd have thought there'd be a little man in the bottom right corner doing sign language as well.
It was a fantastic race, though.
But hang on, just before we get to that. So she comes out of the pits, and on SportsCenter, it cuts away and they go to something else and say, "Oh, and by the way, Tony Kanaan won." They didn't even show...
An outstanding race. I watched it on Tuesday morning.
Which was the first time you could possibly have watched it in the UK.
What's
and we'll come on to that a little bit later.
No, there's not time. And...
Hello, John, by the way.
Hello.
Can I just say that, as my tribute to John and Nick, I'm now enjoying a cup of tea and an Oreo.
Good. Excellent. Because I knew what was coming, i.e. the big accident, every time they went on the back straight and Weldon and Dario were together, I was kind of holding my breath. But that didn't stop the enjoyment. There was some absolutely stunning 200-mile-an-hour racing in that race. It was absolutely marvellous to watch.
But on saying that, and you know what, I don't disagree with that for a minute. Two things I have to say about that race.
But
one, Dario's fight from stalling the engine on the during the yellow flag pit stops, his fight back to the field was absolutely breathtaking.
Outstanding. Again, and that's this, interestingly, Dee, just what I was thinking was, oh, hello, we've seen this before. We saw this when he punctured the tyre at Indianapolis and he drove back through the field. It was his day. I mean, when he was running on his own, he was as quick as all the guys who were running in a draft and who were getting help. That car was so dialed in. That was Dario's race at the weekend. And, I mean, you know, this sounds really bizarre, but the only good thing that happened as far as he was concerned was he came down on top of Scott Dixon, and Dixon didn't get any more points back on him.
Well, he did come back and if he'd done that in a Super Mario World, Scott Dixon would have turned into a turtle.
Yeah, and he'd have got 500 extra points. Which would have been fantastic. Anyway, Kanaan won and he deserves it, because he's had a poor season, not of his own making, as Kanaan.
I think the Dario accident, I think we have to dwell on for a couple of reasons. One is that I want to read you a quote from that published in the Detroit Free Press on Monday from Dario, when he said, "It's not Dan's fault. I don't believe it's my fault. That's one of the reasons I don't really enjoy this type of side-by-side sometimes."
Mm.
And that is that's a very telling statement.
It's what the experts called side draft. And what happens is, when you get going at a certain speed, i.e. above 200 mile an hour, dear listener,
right,
and you pull up alongside someone and it was phenomenal. It was breathtaking to watch with Thomas Schechter, Dan Weldon, Dario, all in the mix there. What happens is, when you get side by side, the aerodynamic effect of your basically being side by side causes a partial vacuum in between the cars, and you get sucked together. You can't help it. Nobody steers into each other, and there was, if there was one, there must have been 8 or 10 times before the accident happened when I thought I was watching the prelude to the accident, having seen the accident and knowing
what
was going to happen. And it's this side draft thing. But I tell you the other thing, Dex, how strong is that car?
That is absolutely remarkable. There's a very funny running gag, obviously, now going on between Michael and Dario, because Dario's wanted to buy that car for his new museum the new memorabilia room in his house in Scotland. And clearly big enough to put the car in. And so effectively, Michael said no. And then after the race, because it's the same car, he ran it in the very similar, you know, fast, big track. Michael effectively said to him afterwards, well, do you still want that car then?
But what I mean, being absolutely serious for a moment, he was, you know, upside down at 200 miles an hour and landed on the roll hoop and scraped along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nothing broke its fall. It was on, when I saw that, first of all, honestly, I was nearly physically sick. Eve made me text Dario because she didn't believe that I was telling her the truth when I said he was all right and he'd done an interview afterwards. She said, no, you're not telling me the truth. I showed her it from the IndyCar website on Monday morning and she was like, nah, there's no way that he walked out of that. I went, no, he walked out of it. He undid his own belts, he got out, unclipped his hands device and walked away from it. And I find that, 5-10 years ago, we could have had 3 fatalities in that one accident.
Absolutely. You know what, and when you think of it, you were talking about the side draft and all that, and there was 17, 18 cars, and only really about 10, 11 cars in a position to actually cause that effect, because that's how when they race together. You imagine back 10, 12 years ago, when there were 32 cars, 18 or so of them, maybe 20 of them, which could run at that pace up the front.
You have to remember, Declan, that there are people listening to this show who won't have any memory of that at all.
I know, it's sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
And when they were making, also when they were making a huge hole in the air, bigger holes in the air than they do now.
Go online and find the last lap battle at Michigan between Montoya and Michael Andretti, and you'll see proper racing. Now this is the great thing, of course, about this is, at the end of the day, fundamentally, is that Dario walked away and he's okay.
Everybody walked away,
although,
yeah, absolutely.
I would say, if I was a betting man, and I went into the bookies, I would check the odds on him retiring at the end of the season, probably, or going to the American Le Mans at the end of the season, have probably gone down.
I think he would have done that anyway if he won the championship. I think that you are absolutely right, and that is more likely now. Right, okay, let's move on from that, Tim.
You want to quickly mention Declan? Yes, I can hear you now.
I have Enrique Bonoli news now.
Oh, go on.
Enrique Bonoli is taking part in the Brazilian Stock Car Championship, where, to be honest, he's been poor.
Oh.
He has his best performance is just 1/15th overall.
Right.
But the winners make interesting reading.
Go on.
We've had Ricardo Maurizio winning a round.
Yeah. Whoa.
We've had Rodrigo Spirifico.
We've
had Tarso Marquez winning around.
Wow.
Finishing midfield, Luciano Berti.
Yes.
And they've got Ingo Hoffmann, who we know. The other Spirifico.
Which other one? Ricardo?
Yes.
Raphael?
No, Ricardo.
Alex?
No, Ricardo.
Ricardo.
Well, he's finished in the top 50, there were already more than 15 people there. So that's Brazilian stock cars. They just had their last round, the 29th of July, won by a guy I'd never heard of called Thiago Camilo.
And I've no doubt they'll be supporting the Mil Mijas, which is the Le Mans Series race at the end of the year.
Almost certainly. Declan wants to quickly mention X Games.
I do. I have to mention the X Rally event, yes.
Oh, what's happened? I meant to watch that.
Yes. By the way, if anybody watching in Europe, if you get a chance to see any of the X Games highlights of any of the events, watch it, because I think it was the most extraordinary 2 days of television I've ever seen.
I love the X Games. Even I sit and watch it. Did you see that guy who came off the vert ramp?
The Aussie who fell 50 feet, only saved by his exploding footwear.
Yeah. What happened in the X Rally? Did Travis Pastrana win it again?
No, he didn't. He was disqualified in the semi-final for crossing lanes at the finish because he couldn't get through. But more importantly, and this is why I want to talk to you and Nick about this, because more importantly than the event itself and who won and who didn't win, McRae got knocked out before the semi-final. Pastrana was knocked out in the semi-final. It was won by a kid called Tanner Faust, who
came from
the US Rally Championship. Boris Said was in it. He had John Buffum as his co-driver. I love that. John Buffum, who won more rallies in the United States than anybody else ever will, ever. And yet he only gets to be Boris Said's co-driver.
That's fantastic.
But the most important thing, I think, about the event is the design and layout of the track and what they did. They an outdoor venue, filled it full of loose, and it's a crisscross track, Frederick Janssen and Michel Mouton and all the good burgers at Race of Champions, take note. When they crisscrossed, they do it where one goes under a ramp takeoff and the other one goes over the top.
So there's not actually a physical bridge?
No. There's a ramp.
So if you were to go, you would actually be flying through the air over the top of your competitor?
Yeah, and at the start, especially at the start when they're still quite close, that's what happens. One flies over the top of the other.
You see, you're never going to get health and safety to sign off on that at Wembley, are you?
Sadly. That's what I was thinking. But the other thing, chaps, is that they also, the event then, like the old stadium cross used to be in the 80s before...
They went outside the stadium.
They went outside.
They've done that the last few years, Dex. It's tremendous.
And that's the way, that is the future of these events, is you've got to give them...
Surely it doesn't work for the spectators if...
Because
all the cars disappear and you can't see them.
You put them on the big screen. You put them on the big screen.
They're at Wembley, they have a congestion charge.
No, they're outside the congestion charge.
Not the new zone, they're out of the new zone.
It goes out to the M25, apparently.
They have them coming down a ramp back in off a very fairly steep entry and exit, so it's not just them coming back in at low level. It's basically they've taken one of the things I love about the X Games, I love about Americans, is they've looked at rallying and go, ooh, this is potentially quite a funky sport. Let's make it one. Instead of people knew you for years and years going, oh, well, how do we cover rallying? I'm not really...
and the run the cars de-restricted as well, which is phenomenal.
Yeah, so it was just...
We'll see that in a couple of weeks' time over here, I'm sure.
And it's well worth watching.
Okay.
Declan, where is NASCAR this weekend?
As you said, it's Watkins Glen.
And who's going to win?
Patrick Carpentier
says Declan, Nick says...
Monty.
And John says...
Is Ron Fellows running?
Yes.
If he gets in, he'll win.
By the way, can we talk next week about the biggest story call this week? Which is Joe Gibbs probably going to Toyota next year. So let's talk about that next week.
Okay.
We'll
talk about that.
And your comments to 0157, obviously, studio@0157.org.
And that is the second part of Ear on the Oval for this week.
And that's it for this week's show. Told you it was going to be absolutely packed. On next week's show, the first of a set of competitions that could get you some tickets for the Brit Car 24 Hours at Silverstone later on in the year as we begin our build-up to that event. Hardly time for me to say thank you to everybody, but thank you Declan, thank you Nick, thank you Tim, thank you to Robert Dornbos, of course, who joined us on the telephone. I'm John Hindhoff. That was Midweek Motorsport. We'll see you again next week at just after 8 o'clock here on Globecast Radio.